All the Best, a portrait of Australia through sound.
This episode is made possible by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website for your business, blog, portfolio, or wedding.
Squarespace provides you with designer templates, an easy-to-use interface, and even a free domain name.
Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/FBI radio and use code FBI for 10% off.
I wouldn't call it traumatic, but I did nearly die in a fire one time. About 2 years ago, I was living in the UK in a place called Leicester, which is up in the north of England. So as a result, I did a lot of travelling in the UK, and it was over Easter in 2013. Me and my friend went up to Scotland. So we went to Inverness, which is where like Loch Ness is, and it's beautiful. And it all started relatively auspiciously. You know, we got there and had a few days and, you know, went to markets, went walking and, you know, did like horse riding adventures and just getting amongst it. And then one night we went to this local pub and, you know, had a few drinks and dancing away. And we got back to our hostel at about like 2 or 3 in the morning and fell into bed, and that was it. And my friend who I was traveling with, she's a very light sleeper, and she woke up at about 5 in the morning wanting to go to the toilet. So she woke up and I was dead to the world. I was just asleep, and I remember just being woken up with her shouting my name really loudly, just saying fire. I was like, what? So I sat up in bed and I turned the light on, but the light didn't make a difference. The whole room was pitch black with smoke. Like, I could see maybe about a foot of fresh air at the bottom of the floor, and it's very quick. Like, I was just in like t-shirt and underpants. I just jumped into bed, and everyone in the hostel, there's maybe like 3 or 4 other people in the room, and Tara's just shouting fire, fire. And I'm like, what? Anyway, I turned the light on and saw that there was smoke, and it was just like instant, not even panic or like terror. It was just like, get up and go. So I grabbed my handbag, which was beside my bed, because I had my passport and my wallet and everything in it. I left my suitcase, left my phone, left my computer, and I just grabbed my handbag, grabbed my shoes. The rest of us in the hostel just jumped out of bed and we ran down the stairs. And we were on the 8th floor, and the fire, we found out later, started in the room next to where I was sleeping. It was in the kitchen. And as we were walking, like, we just ran out. Ran through the smoke, and I got like a burn on my face from when we walked past from the fire. Like, it was a radiant heat burn. But so we ran down the stairs, and the lower we got, the clearer the air got until we could sort of breathe again and see again. And we ran out onto the street, and so there was about 50 foreigners in Scotland, all like in various degrees of nudity, you know, either in their undies or pajamas or whatever, just standing at 5:30 in the morning on this Scottish street, like, freezing cold. Like, it's April, so that's their like end of winter, beginning of spring type weather, and it was so cold. And just standing there holding like a handbag and looking around at each other going, what just happened? And we looked up, and the room where we'd been, the entire roof was like ablaze, like flames coming up and smoke peeling out. And I'm just wondering, like, how I didn't even smell that or wake up. Like, it was on fire, and I was just sleeping away. And I wonder, like, if Tara hadn't have woken up to go to the bathroom, like, if we would have woken up at all.
Yeah.
Because about 10 minutes afterwards, the entire roof, including the room where we were sleeping, just collapsed and just imploded on itself, and the fire, like, leapt up, and there were sparks in the sky. And
you're listening to All the Best. I'm Kira Rasmussen.
And I'm Kira Rasmussen.
us that day might have ended in death. There are near-death experiences. But there are degrees, right? Some people's near misses are nearer than others. Rachel was looking to speak to someone who filled that clinical, scientific definition of a person who had had a near-death experience. That was when she met Brad. He had an experience that you'd think would be extreme enough for the scientists to count you in.
I was in the plane, I was absolutely shitting myself because I'm really scared of heights. I was kind of scared of heights before. And yeah, but I was excited and I knew there was going to be this real adrenaline rush because I've always been quite a thrill seeker. And yeah, so we jump out the plane, which was, it was amazing. Like free falling is just one of those feelings that you can't really describe to anyone else. You actually are falling through the sky. So it's really bizarre. And a lot of people told me before I went, they're like, oh, skydiving, just you don't really feel like you're falling, just feels like air's coming at you because you don't have that perspective and height. But I could feel myself, I was falling through the air. Then eventually I felt the thrust of what I thought was the first parachute and it didn't slow us down. So I just felt this massive pull, which is normal, but then we didn't slow down. So we're still going the same speed and you can just hear this parachute kind of like flailing around, not doing its job. And I could hear the instructor, he's swearing, we're spiraling out of control, we're just moving so violently. And then I felt another thrust, which was the emergency parachute, and that had come out, but it got tangled with the other one. So basically, there's these two parachutes that were just not open. They were just kind of like plastic bags, just flailing around, just like pieces of plastic. And that's when we started to like spin completely out of control. My harness was nearly coming off, like we were shaking that much. And you know, he just kept swearing. He's like, fuck, fuck, we're going down. And that pretty much continued right up until I did hit the ground. So it didn't really feel like I fell onto the ground. It kind of felt like the earth came to smack me. Yeah, it was pretty extreme. Like going down, I just knew I was going to die. That's what was going through my head. I just knew that was the outcome. So I just remember, like, I was just moving around. I just couldn't believe that the earth was coming closer and closer. I'm like, cool, I'm gonna die. I brought my whole family here to watch me die, and I just felt really guilty. And it's weird. Like a lot of people say, yeah, your life flashes before your eyes, and it's true, and it's so corny and cliche, but it does. And I just remember feeling so guilty because I had, you know, killed this guy that was strapped to me. It was a tandem dive. I had, you know, murdered myself in front of my family. Just these really obscure thoughts that were really morbid. So we hit the ground and yeah, that was possibly the worst imaginable pain I could ever fathom. It was just extreme. Like, because we were going about 80 k's an hour when we hit the ground and yeah, I was just extremely winded. I was shocked. I was really overwhelmed. I couldn't feel my legs. I couldn't feel my shoulders. Couldn't really feel anything. I couldn't move. I was still strapped to my tandem instructor who was underneath me by the stage. And yeah, I was just looking at the sky, I couldn't move my neck either. And my tandem instructor was unresponsive at the time, so I thought he was dead. So I kind of thought I was just laying on some dead guy on the ground. And we were on a golf course, so we were near this little lake, this body of water. So we'd kind of ricocheted from the earth to like an embankment. So we're just muddy, I was underneath a parachute, I was strapped to someone, I was freezing cold. I couldn't breathe, I was just winded, my ribs were absolutely killing me, my back was just on fire, I thought someone had gone and ripped my spinal cord out of my body. I just didn't really know what happened for a while, it took me a while to realise what had happened, and then I was just grabbing my tandem instructor by the hand, I was saying, are you okay, wake up, please be alive, and yeah, I was just crying a lot. I was just in a different place, I just couldn't believe what was happening, and eventually we were found by some golfers and, you know, they rushed over to us. They separated us. They got us out of the water. They, you know, propped my head up and they called the ambulance and the ambulance came. And then we went in the ambulance and that's when I saw my family. They were all, they all saw it happen. So they saw us spiral out of control. They saw the parachutes not work. They saw me hit the ground from a few kilometers away. And yeah, I just remember being in the hospital bed within the ambulance and just hearing my mom and hearing my boyfriend like, Brad, are you okay? You okay? We love you. You'll be all right. All this kind of stuff. And yeah, the first night in hospital was like the worst night ever. I was literally screaming. Like I couldn't move my back, couldn't move my neck, couldn't move my shoulders. My legs eventually came to, And I remember the first night trying to sleep, and every time I closed my eyes, I could just feel myself falling. I just didn't feel safe, and I was just calling the nurse repeatedly. I'm like, you've got to knock me out, you've got to give me some medication. She said, no, we've given you enough. So I was just in immense pain, which I thought would never end. I was in a really bad state at that point. And then eventually got better enough that I could leave the hospital, and then I started my long, long, long recovery, which is kind of still going, I guess, in an emotional aspect. But I left the hospital, and that's what started the next stage, so to speak. Yeah. I was recovering for nearly 4 months. So I was in a neck brace and a back brace for 4 months. Couldn't walk at all, hardly. Couldn't really do anything but leave my bed, which I had to lie flat. So I looked at the roof a lot, which was fun, but didn't do anything for 4 months. Hardly did anything except hate myself, really. Just, it was a pretty dark place to be. And, you know, I had a lot of people say, you're so lucky, you survived, you should think positive. And I'm one of the most positive people on earth. Like, I'm so happy all the time. I'm always just jumping off the walls, excited. But I just felt really guilty, and I didn't really see, you know, light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak. I just didn't like the person that I was. I didn't like being confined. I didn't feel good about, you know, what the future could bring. And I was working in a really amazing job at the time, which I couldn't go back to. You know, I couldn't see my friends, could hardly see my family. I just became like this disgruntled, aggressive, mean tosser. Like, I'm just laying in my bedroom all the time on some stupid drugs. So yeah, it was a very dark time, but people were patient with me. So I was very lucky that my family and my boyfriend were really patient, and they understood what I was going through, and they really helped me get to the point where I am today, where I'm able to, you know, work, and I'm social, and I can leave the house, and I feel good about myself. But yeah, those 4 months were pretty intense. Even after I got all the gear off, the neck brace and the back brace, and after the bruises had healed and the scratches and all that sort of thing, I was doing a lot of physiotherapy, a lot of psychological therapy, which still continues. And yeah, I just kind of came to terms with, okay, this is a permanent thing. A lot of aspects of what has happened will stay with me until the day I die. Yeah, it's a funny thing. Like, I knew as soon as I hit the ground that I was alive, I knew that something special had happened. I knew that it was just a complete one in a trillion chance that not only for an accident to happen while skydiving, like, skydiving injuries are quite rare in themselves, but for two parachutes not to work and to survive and to be as intact as I am now physically is just unheard of. It's the first in the world, you know what I mean? So it's weird. Like, I do feel really special, but I also feel like, holy moly, this is like, it's larger than me, so to speak. Like, what has happened to me is almost incomprehensible for me to even digest. But yeah, every doctor was like, oh, so it just says here parachute, what does that mean? And I had to explain the story to them. I think I've told the story in different varieties, nothing short of 10,000 times, literally. And every doctor's like, oh, wow, that's amazing, tell us. And every single person I've met has said that. And like, I do believe that, but I try not to think about that aspect too much because it's quite overwhelming. Like, I don't want to be weighed down by the miraculousness of it. I just want to kind of accept it and say, I'm special. Like, I always thought I was special, but now I know I am, I guess.
You say you're still recovering now, and I guess this is going to be something that's going to be with you forever. And it's not, you know, a skydiving incident, as you say, is quite rare. It's not like there's a, you know, a group where you can go with other people and, you know, share your experiences and stuff. What I've been, you know, interested about in people who've got these accidents, do you ever feel isolated because you can't fully express that experience to anyone else, even verbally, especially when there's things that are so overwhelming?
Yeah, for sure. And isolation is really important about, like, what you said just then. Because, like, no one else has been through what I went through except the guy that was strapped to me. And we still haven't spoken. It's just, I don't know. And, you know, we've tried to reach out to each other, but, you know, extraneous circumstances are kind of preventing that at the moment. But, you know, we might get in touch and, you know, have a beer over it or something one day. You know, it's nearly been a year and a half. But it feels like yesterday, and the isolation is something that I really experienced hard. Because people were just like, okay, you fell from the sky, you break your back, you're all good. Like, you'll survive. And it's not that easy, you know. Like, I still have physical pain from it. It's very light compared to what it was, of course. But, you know, there's still physical pain, like the emotional aftermath I think is what is most severe. But yeah, it was hard. Like, I tried to open up to people, but I just didn't bother. And I'm an open book. Like, nothing's sacred with me. So that's why I was just a completely different person during my recovery, because I just refused to talk about it. And I just knew that people would just fluff around it. They'd say, oh, you'll be right, you know, just get better, that kind of thing, which is good. And I knew that they were coming from a good place. But unless you believe it yourself, you can't interpret anything from anyone else. Like, people will say, oh yeah, well, I you know, a bull hit me or something. It's like, oh, that's good, and I feel sorry for you. But unless you, and I was just, that's why I was in such a bad mental place, because I couldn't take any support, hardly. Like, I just didn't believe what anyone was saying. Everyone kept saying, you're so lucky, you just should thank your gods, buy a lotto ticket. And I was like, yeah. It's really hard, because yeah, no one has gone through what I've gone through, but there has been similar things. And I've been lucky that I've connected with people who have gone through similar experiences. Obviously, they're very different, and there's a lot of contrast, but you can sympathize with your mental health and how you recover, and even talking about hospitals and things like that. It makes you feel awesome. It makes you feel less of a freak, so to speak. You know what I mean? It just makes you feel like, okay, I'm not so alone.
What's got me into this one was this story, is that there's some research that shows that people who've been through experiences like you have, and people who've really confronted death, I guess, that a lot of survivors say that they have a lot less fear of death afterwards. I'm not sure if you think about it much, or if you have thought about it, but has your attitude in general to sort of life and death and what motivates you and what used to worry you, has that changed dramatically at all?
Yeah, definitely. I had so much time to think, and I still think. I think every single day. And yeah, death is a funny thing. And I think I only really came to this realization a few months ago, where I realized I'm not scared of death, and I'm more scared of pain. I'm scared of surviving pain. I think that's what is my greatest fear these days. And I'm scared of heights for obvious reasons. I can't even step on a second story balcony without my hands shaking. So it's at a really extreme level at the moment, which will improve with therapy in the future. But yeah, death for me, I'm not scared of death because I don't know what it is, you know. And I've thought about this because I knew this is what you're going to ask me, and I wanted to try and articulate it in a really concise answer. And because death is so unknown, I can't fear it because I don't know what it is. So if I just happen to die right now, I don't know what's beyond. Like, it could be anything. So I can't really be afraid of what I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I'm just more scared of pain and what I went through. I'm scared of knowing that I'm going to die, but without dying. I think that for me is one of the biggest fears ever. And the only thing when it comes to death that I'm afraid of is like leaving my family behind, all that kind of stuff that a lot of people share. And it's a common fear. But for me, death, because it's such a mystery, and because we know nothing about it, no one can say I was dead and I came back. You know, like, they couldn't be dead for a year or something and come back. Like, no one knows what's really beyond. So I can't really be scared of it.
That's Brad Guy speaking to All the Best producer Rachel Dexter.
Support for All the Best comes from FBI sponsors Squarespace.
Set yourself apart with a beautiful website at squarespace.com/FBI radio and use the code FBI for 10% off.
Now, you'd think that would be the kind of near-death experience she was talking about, right? Nope. To account for the psychologists, doctors, neurologists, and mystics who study these people, you need to have clinically died. Falling from a plane isn't going to cut it. You should have seen the light. There's a study saying that people who've had near-death experiences, like a real one, not just a close brush, means your whole outlook on life changes. You're happier, less afraid of death, less materialistic, and more empathetic. This is Natasha Tassel-Matamua. She's a psychology lecturer based in New Zealand who's been researching the topic for the past 4 years.
When we are talking about a near-death experience in terms of my research, we're talking about people who have come close to death, been unconscious for whatever reason, and yet during this period of apparent unconsciousness, they report that they actually were very conscious and experiencing a range of different things. And what we tend to find when we do this is that people who have had a near-death experience usually report a common set of characteristics that occurred during their experience. And these characteristics could be, for example, moving through a tunnel, seeing a bright light, conversing with a spiritual being, or seeing deceased others. They also usually very often report very pleasant feelings. They can also report a life review and various sorts of things. And intriguingly, people can also report feeling like they were outside of their body but still being able to perceive what was happening around their physical body. And some of the common examples which you may have heard about are people saying, well, I had a heart attack, but I could see what people were doing when they were trying to resuscitate my body. So when we ask people in terms of trying to figure out whether they had a near-death experience or not, they will typically report either one or all or a couple of these features.
And I guess what got me interested in this is a few articles about people's changed attitudes to death. Can, you know, just close brushes with death, can they also produce the same effect?
What studies have shown is that people who have a close brush with death and people who have a close brush with death and a near-death experience both tend to undergo some sort of change after their experience. But what has been found is that people who have a near-death experience tend to undergo more significant change. And so their change tends to be focused on different feelings or a greater subjective quality of life. This change doesn't always occur straight away. Because of the unusual nature of a near-death experience, a person may feel that what happened to them is very difficult to reconcile with their everyday living. So sometimes it can be a while before the positive benefits of the experience occur. But usually there are very positive benefits, and these can include a changed perspective, which is usually a lot more positive, increased compassion and concern for other people, less materiality. People often find that, well, I'm not really interested in material stuff anymore, not really interested in being competitive. And generally their focus in life is about service to others or about compassion. That tends to be a very frequent word that is used, you know, this feeling of compassion for other people. So the difference between those who have a close brush with death without an NDE and those that have a close brush with death but with an NDE is quite significant. So even though they both have changes, those who have the NDE, the changes tend to be more. And research has shown that the changes tend to last over time as well, in comparison to those that just have a close brush with death. So it seems that a near-death experience seems to catalyse a variety of overwhelmingly beneficial changes for a person, which don't appear to be apparent just through having a close brush with death.
It must be because I assume that you've had a lot of contact with people who've had near-death experiences. It must be sort of a confronting time, because I imagine, I've never had a near-death experience, but I can imagine that the feelings and experience can sometimes be hard to verbalise and explain to people, and it must sometimes feel isolating if you can't explain what it was like to someone, and to get, you know, support for something that, you know, changes your life and the way you view your life.
Yeah, and I think the struggle is for two reasons. I think there's the struggle of when they do finally get an opportunity to talk about their experience, or when they feel that they can trust someone enough to talk about their experience, they generally do have difficulty explaining it. And the difficulty isn't necessarily in articulating what happened. You know, they tend to be able to say, look, I went through this tunnel, and, you know, so they can explain the features of the experience. But one of the difficulties they have in explaining is the emotions that went with the experience. So most of them say, well, that, you know, I can't, there are no worldly terms to explain how I felt. they say that their feelings are so overwhelmingly positive that there are just no equivalent words that can explain how they felt. Another thing that they tend to struggle with, and that I've interviewed lots and lots of people about their NDE, and those that say they encountered the light or a being of light usually become incredibly emotional when they're talking about that. And again, they just say that they can't really describe the feeling that they got from being in the presence of this being, other than, you know, I mean, the closest they say they can get is the feeling of complete unconditional love and complete acceptance for them as they are as an individual. But they say, you know, even describing that doesn't come close to how they felt during their experience. I think there is a lot of stigma around talking about unusual experiences, particularly experiences that deviate from currently accepted norms of reality, which of course near-death experiences deviate quite vastly from our norms of reality. You know, how is it possible for someone who is dead to still have conscious abilities? So I think people, especially people from Western cultures, really struggle to talk about these experiences because they're fearful that, well, if I do, I'm going to be labelled as crazy, as wacky, as psychologically unwell. There's definitely a strong belief in the NDE sort of research community that they're heavily underreported because of that. So we think there are a lot more people that have these experiences. They just don't talk about them because of the fear of being stigmatised or labelled as a bit sort of wacky.
This episode of All the Best was produced at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. Thanks to episode producer Rachel Dexter and to Maddie and Brad for sharing their stories. Our executive producer is Heidi Pett. My co-host is Michael Bryden and I'm Pip Rasmussen. All the Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. And if you want a second chance to hear more great stories, visit allthebestradio.com and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.
You've been listening to All the Best, a portrait of Australia through sound.
All the Best is made possible by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website for your business, blog, portfolio, or wedding.
Squarespace provides you with designer templates, an easy-to-use interface, and award-winning 24/7 support.
Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/FBI Radio and use code FBI for 10% off.